This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll discover how a young cancer survivor is devoting his life to cancer research. Plus, how a new hypothesis as to the causes of clubfoot may transform the way this deformity is treated. But first, the importance of kidney transplants in saving lives. Well, nationwide, there are over 100,000 people on waiting lists for organ donations, and for some, time can simply run out. And kidneys are among the organs with the greatest demand and the greatest transplant success. Well, here to tell us more about this is Dr. J. Keith Melanson. He's a professor of surgery and the director of transplantation at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So nationwide, I guess kidneys are in very high demand.
They are. In the field, we kind of feel like we're the victim of our own success in this, because kidneys do so well when they're transplanted. But nationwide, there are over 85,000 people who are waiting for kidney transplant, and we only do about 16,000 per year. So the average wait is going to be 5 or 6 years for a kidney transplant. Here in the Central New York region, people wait 4 to 5 years before they can receive a transplant. And the problem with that is if you have to wait for a deceased donor transplant, many patients, actually upwards of 30%, are going to die before they even get an opportunity to receive a transplant. Yeah. So kidney transplant is very successful. If you get a transplant, it is it's very good for your health. People that get transplanted pretty much have a normal life expectancy compared to people that have end-stage renal disease and have to be on dialysis. If you're on dialysis, your life's band is very much shortened. So transplant is the way to go, but unfortunately, we don't have nearly as much of this commodity to go around.
Wow. Yeah, and I wonder why. I mean, I recall reading somewhere that the shortage has actually increased because the demand has grown. And why is there more of a demand for kidneys? Obviously, the success of the transplant.
Right.
But are there conditions that are making that happen?
Yeah. So, you know, the two top reasons to have kidney disease would be diabetes and hypertension. So most patients that are sitting on the transplant list right now have a combination of those. So now diabetes is the number one reason to have end-stage renal disease. As you might know, in this country right now, there is an epidemic of diabetes, both type 1 and type 2. Type 2 diabetes is mostly associated with obesity, and we have a big obesity problem in this country.
Yeah,
and,
true.
And therefore, we have a lot more kidney disease. So the other point is, because kidney transplant is now offered to many more patients with kidney disease, in other words, we've liberalized our criteria, many more people will qualify to get a transplant. If you go back to the early days of transplant, a lot of the people that we transplant today would never have been transplanted back then.
Is that because of newer technology, better skills? Why did it change?
Yeah, it's because of better technology. The surgeries are better tolerated because the care in the operating room, the care in the intensive care unit, the care in the hospital, all those things have gotten better. So so people are able to survive that big operation, whereas decades ago, if you were over the age of 50, if you had diabetes, that used to be a reason not to get a transplant.
Wow.
So we didn't do diabetics back in even the 1980s. So our technology and the fact that we have done a better job of transplanting these people mean that more people qualify to receive transplant.
And
again, there's a shortage.
Yeah, and as you said, with the increase in diabetes and now them being qualified for transplantation, it sounds like the numbers have just continued to grow.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about, well, you also mentioned that the shortage can affect lives, I mean, can lead to death if the people have to wait too long.
So. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the main problem right now, if you're on the transplant list and you don't have a living donor, chances are you have a pretty good chance of dying before you ever would receive an organ offer, which is unfortunate.
That really is. So let's talk about donation, because you've alluded to a couple of, you said, basically waiting for a death, a donation from a death, mm-hmm. a new death, mm-hmm. or a living donor. So let's talk about, I think there are several different ways you can get kidneys. Tell us about that.
You can, basically, the two main ways is to either receive it from someone after they die, or you can receive it from someone that's alive. And usually, if it's going to be a living donor, it's going to be one of your family members or a friend that's going to come forward and donate to you. So a little less than half of the transplants we do today are going to come from living donors. The other way to get a transplant is a deceased donor. And a deceased donor transplant can occur in two basic ways. One is once a person is what's called a brain dead, when you don't have blood supply going to the brain, by U.S. laws, you are considered deceased, although your body could still be alive. So if a person is in that category, like after an accident with a head injury, their family can decide at that point that they could be a donor. The other way to be a deceased donor would be if you have a medical condition that you're not going to recover from, however, you're not technically brain dead, then once we stop life support, you would die quickly. That's another way for a person to be a donor because, again, by U.S. laws, if life support is stopped and your heart stops beating, that's why it's called cardiac death, and your heart stops beating, then you're declared dead. So those are the two ways to be a deceased donor. Or you could be a living donor.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with kidney transplant surgeon Dr. J. Keith Blanson, and we're talking about kidney transplants, and you just so well explained the issues of donation. But it seems to me that there would be a lot of challenges, therefore, in procuring organs.
Yeah, well, so the main thing when I talk to my patients is to try to get them to understand the whole process. And because the patients themselves actually become the best advocates for living donation as well as deceased donation. Once people are on the list to be deceased donors, then there's this whole complicated process where there is an interaction with the healthcare industry and the organ procurement industry in letting us know in transplant that this person is available to be a donor. That actually, given all of the interchangeable parts, works quite well. And people that want to be donors are usually, the organs are procured in a very humane fashion, and everything works well up to that point. The main obstacle is really just getting enough people to sign up to be donors. The saddest thing is when someone dies in an appropriate way and they have not consented to be a donor.
Yeah, it seems like that seems... I actually had the opportunity to speak with someone involved in organ procurement in this region and said that not enough people really consider organ donation or even know much about it. And I know there's been a new law that just went into effect in New York, I think it's called Lauren's Law, this past October, where right now, if you register for a driver's license, anyone over the age of 18, you have to answer a question if you want to join the state's donor list. And it's at this point, it's an optional question, but I think they're moving in the direction of wanting people to at least be aware that there's a need and that, you know, you could participate in that way, in giving your eyes or, you know, any of your organs if you should die in the appropriate way. So
yeah, it's a great law to have because I'm up from Maryland, and I will tell you, we have this similar sort of law there, and I recently got my license renewed and had to sign up. And it's great because you don't really plan to die and become an organ donor. So it's something that you should sign up for when you get your license or when you think about it, because there's always this possibility that you will be in that situation. And then it's your family that's going to be making the decision. It's much easier for your family to make that decision if you've already signed up to be a donor. And that's what we need in this country right now. We honestly need more deceased donors to come forward, because obviously you don't need the organs at that point. It's a little tougher to push living donation. I mean, obviously people want to be living donors, but there is some risk in being a living donor, whereas there's no risk in being a deceased donor.
Absolutely. Tell me if you know much about this new research. There was some newest research that they were doing with liver buds, growing liver buds. And, I mean, do you think that there's any hope in the next, you know, in the foreseeable, I don't know, next several decades, that we'll be in a position to grow things like kidneys?
Absolutely. You know, in our field right now, that is the most promising research of taking cell-based therapies and then turning these cells into new organs. I think what's going to happen first, before we get to actually growing our own organs, would be to take our human cells and infuse them into animal tissues so that you can transplant animal tissues. You know, pig kidneys, hearts, livers are very similar to our organs. However, they have built-in proteins that make us really reject them. So you may have heard of people that have pig valves.
Yes, I was going to say that. Yeah. I had heard that.
So that works because the cells have actually been removed from the cartilage. But, you know, you wouldn't be able to do that with organ transplant. However, if we could infuse human cells and have the human cells cover at least the surfaces of the animal cells, then you could probably have animal transplant, which is called xenotransplantation. And I think that's going to be the next step before we get to the point of actually growing our own organs.
That's fascinating. I had not heard that before. And that's very, very hopeful.
It is. I honestly, in the history of transplant in this country, there have been some sometimes when chimpanzee and monkey organs, as well as other types of animals' organs, were used back in the 60s, and some of them were surprisingly successful for a short period of time. So there's a lot of hope there. I think we're going to get there before we get to actually growing our own organs.
Is there also in this line of research better research or better knowledge with regard to the rejection currently that's going on? You know, the whole idea of the immune response that each person has to someone else's organ.
No, absolutely.
Are we doing better in that regard?
Oh, we're doing much better. For matter of fact, that's probably in the last 20 years in transplant, that's probably the biggest advance that we made. You know, from the time that I was a medical student to where we are now, rejection, honestly, is not something that we have to worry much about because the medicine has improved so much so. Our main issue today, other than just having enough organs, would be long-term graft survival because our medications, although they're very, very good at stopping rejection, long-term, these strong medications take a toll on the organs. So that's really our main issue. So what we would like to do is we would like to have protocols where people stop taking the medicines after a certain period of time. That's called transplant tolerance. And that's something that I've done research in and a lot of people have, because I really think that's another part of the future of transplant. If we could get our patients where they didn't have to take these strong medicines for so many years, then once the organs become part of their bodies, then they could be like any other organ in their body.
That's fascinating. I was wondering, though, if some of this infusion of cells that you were talking about with regard to the animal model could also play a role in changing the rejection factor.
Oh, absolutely. For matter of fact, you know, here in Boston, that is exactly what's going on. They're infusing cells with the organs to decrease rejection.
I also understand a little bit of time we have left. I don't want to run out of time. You're brand new to this faculty, and you are the director of transplantation. We're so very lucky to have you. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you come from?
So I'm originally from Louisiana. That's why I have the French last name. I'm from southern Louisiana. And I did a college and medical school. I went to Tulane Medical School. I did my residency and surgery there as well. I left New Orleans and went to Minneapolis, and I did a transplant fellowship at the University of Minnesota. After finishing my fellowship, I was at Johns Hopkins and then Georgetown before moving over to George Washington University. And I started coming up here to Upstate approximately 1 year ago to head up their program. So I'm originally from Louisiana, then the East Coast, and now I'm up in Syracuse.
Well, we are very, very lucky to have you. And I just so thank you for taking the time out of what I'm sure is an incredibly busy schedule to come in and talk with us. Maybe you'll come back after you've been here a while and tell us a little bit about your dreams or hopes or expectations for this whole new department.
Yes, No, it's a wonderful beginning, and I can't wait.
My guest has been Dr. J. Keith Melanson. He's professor of surgery and the director of transplantation at Upstate Medical University. Thanks again for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. next, how a young cancer survivor is devoting himself to finding the cure for cancer. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. With all the dysfunction in Washington these days and the sequester fiasco, research funding has taken quite a hit. But there are still those intrepid young scientists making a career choice to devote themselves to their dreams in research. Well, here with us is one such individual. Chris Lucchese is a graduate student in pharmacology at Upstate Medical University, and he's here with us to tell us about it. Welcome, Chris. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a grad student in pharmacology. Tell us what that means. What exactly is that?
Well, unlike what most people might think, I actually don't study drugs like pharmacology. I'm more focused on different proteins that are involved in cancer metastasis and seeing if there's oncogenes or tumor suppressors and what they might actually do in cancer cells.
So your focus really is cancer?
Yes.
And what the underpinnings for either the growth and development of cancer or what might suppress it?
Exactly. I focus mostly on breast and colon cancer. So that's what I primarily work on, breast and colon cancer cell lines, to see what's going on in those cell lines.
So how did you get involved in this kind of thing? What led you to thinking about working in this arena?
Well, I got lucky in high school. My school actually had a biotechnology center. So I remember the first experiment we did, we took bacterial cells and we transformed them with a pGlow, which is a GFP expressing protein. And we made these bacteria cells glow under fluorescent lights. And from that time I was hooked onto research. So I did, from college, I did research, and then the next progression was grad school.
Wow. So why cancer, though? Is there something about cancer that was... I mean, obviously, cancer is the great killer these days, mm-hmm. and one of the last frontiers, so to speak, of, you know, taking so many lives. But was there something about cancer that...
Well, I remember in AP biology when we started learning about cancer and realizing that it's nothing really crazy. It's really your body, and then it gets a mutation, and then your own cells are starting to propagate at an uncontrolled rate. So it wasn't like there was a virus or something that you can just target and kill, but it's your own body that's going haywire. So that intrigued me, that you have a cell system in your body that is mutated, and then it more or less learns how to survive at a better rate. So it's a more advanced cell line, I guess you can say. So it always intrigued me that your own body is learning to survive better, but ultimately this leads to your demise. So it was kind of this fascinating...
It's ironic, system. Isn't it?
It is very ironic.
There's kind of a huge irony to the whole thing.
It is. I mean, cancer cells are learning to survive better than your normal system.
Tell us why you say better. That's an interesting perspective. I've never heard that before, because most people think of cancer as the great invader, the poison, you know, somehow it's taken over our being, so to speak.
Yeah, so by taking over, it means it's surviving better. They learn how to use metabolites better. They cause their own vascularization, different circulatory systems, all of that. So in essence, they're learning how to evade all of the normal systems that end up causing cell death, like apoptosis. And they learn how to use different metabolic systems in order to survive in different, you know, niches in your body. So they are effectively...
But by their sheer growth and development, they overtake important organ structures.
Exactly.
They interrupt the natural functioning of the body. Mm-hmm. So exactly what you said, they may survive better in their little world, but the whole organism is going to be destroyed as a result.
Exactly.
That's very interesting. Yeah. You had some personal experience with cancer yourself?
Yeah, when I was 17, I got diagnosed with a neuroblastoma in my maxillary sinus, which was kind of rare for a neuroblastoma.
And that's an eye tumor?
If I remember correctly, neuroblastomas are usually a childhood cancer, and it's, I think, in the stomach. Oh. So I had it in my right maxillary sinus, which was pretty weird. Surgeons were kind of confused when they saw that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you obviously... were successful in treatment.
Yeah, I had the whole resection done when I was 17. Then I went through chemotherapy and radiation and all that lovely stuff. So I'm 10 years out now, so thank God, but everything seems to be clear.
Wow. Well, that's wonderful. So did that enhance your interest, though? I mean, obviously you seem, in a sense, almost awestruck by the power of cancer, but at the same time, you yourself were a victim,
Yeah,
so
I think I wouldn't say that it was like the driving force to studying cancer. I knew I wanted to before, and then having had cancer myself, I think it just made it easier for me to have. When you think about cancer therapy, you think about the patients, and having been a patient, I understand what it means when they say creating a drug with less cytotoxic effects and things of that magnitude. So in that sense, I think it was easier for me to study the cancer and the progression of the drugs, because I understood what we ultimately wanted to achieve.
You had more empathy and compassion, I would think,
exactly,
as you said, for the side effects and all the problems. So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. I'm here with grad student Chris Lucchese, and we're talking about a career in cancer research. We're just a career in research, in fact, but you have chosen cancer. So what's going to happen? I want to get into some of the details of your research, but how do you envision, you know, yourself going forward? What's the plan?
Well, after you get X amount of publications, then a committee decides whether or not they think you're fit to be a PhD. So then you defend your dissertation. And then from there, we have postdocs, which is you move on to another university or possibly industry, and you work for a few years until you finally figure out where you want to go. I mean, you can take two paths. You can do industry or you can do academia. You know, industry, I guess you can say you don't have as much freedom in the research, but if you stick with academia, then you can focus on what you really want to do.
But in just to clarify here, if you're in industry, they're funding your research. If you're in academia, do you need to then go out on and find grants?
Yes.
And that's where the whole government issue and the NIH issue and all of the sequester issue may play a role.
It's difficult right now to find funding. I mean, even as a postdoc, to find funding is pretty complicated. And a lot of professors are having issues finding funding. So the whole academia aspect of where to go after you get your PhD is, it's more daunting now than I think it ever has been. It's just more difficult to find positions in labs. I mean, there's a lot of labs that are willing to have you, but they don't have the funding to support you. So you can get your own funding, but again, that's short as well. So the whole aspect of academia is kind of...
It's tragic because that's really where our future lies in terms of breakthroughs, in terms of research. Because if you depend solely on, you know, working in a business or in, you know, some kind of a entrepreneurial setting, then they're only going to research things that might in fact pay off for them financially. Whereas in academia, hopefully people are looking for the public interest. I mean, they're willing to study things that might help all of us, whether there was big bucks behind it or not.
Exactly. And I also think that we're also hurting a lot of the up-and-coming scientists. You have a huge pool of very bright people that are coming out, but they can't find jobs, so then they're taking jobs elsewhere that might not be, you know, research or science-related anymore just to make ends meet. And it's really sad. I think the whole downhill effect of all the sequestration is that we're going to end up hurting our whole scientific field in the long run. And I think we're starting to see
that
now.
It could really set us back years.
Exactly.
Yes, especially when you think of how long it takes to undertake any kind of significant breakthroughs in research. You need steady and consistent support over time,
exactly,
over long periods of time. So tell us about your research projects currently. What exactly are you looking at?
So I'm working on a tumor suppressor protein that was found in esophageal cancer cell lines. And what was interesting about this protein is in most cancers, it's downregulated because of a short tandem repeat that causes a chromosomal deletion.
I'm going to stop you there because that was a lot of jargon.
Yeah.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, help us understand in lay terms what you meant.
Okay, so tumor suppressors are genes that are expressed that would cause the death of a tumor cell or cancer cell.
So in other words, it's going to really kind of cut to the chase. It's going to undercut this cancer gene, the cancer cell that you suggested before was almost Herculean, could beat out everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And a tumor suppressor really kind of is basically the thing that's going to undercut it.
Exactly. I mean, it helps stop its spread and its growth. On the contrast, you have oncogenes, which propagate cancer. They help it survive. They help it metastasize. So my gene is a really small protein, which was fascinating, in that when I make cancer cells, so we can grow cancer cells in petri plates, like breast cancer cell lines, colon cancer cell lines. If I make these cells re-express this protein, it kills them all. So that was fascinating. And then when we take what we consider non-tumorigenic cell lines, so it's not a breast cancer cell line anymore, it's just a breast cell line. It's the closest thing we can grow in a lab that's a normal cell line. And I re-express this protein, it doesn't kill them. So we are finding that.
So it's targeted just to the cancer cells.
And then this story got really interesting when we found that there was a single somatic point mutation. So on the amino acid.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so the proteins are made up of amino acids. And if you change one of these amino acids to a different amino acid, it turns this tumor suppressor protein into an oncogene. And it actually converted multiple drug resistance.
Okay, so you took something that would suppress or kill a cancer cell, and by changing the chain of amino acids, you made it one that would make cancer cells grow?
Exactly. It helped protect them against chemotherapies. So that was fascinating. It was just one single amino acid substitution caused the complete opposite effect in these cells.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty intense. I mean, that sounds pretty cutting edge in terms of...
Well, I think the more relevant is that because it was from a patient sample, we found these mutations, that if, you know, I think cancer therapy is going more towards patient-specific therapies. So if you can...
Targeted, it's kind of what they call individualized targeted
exactly.
therapy.
So if you can...
Personalized.
If you can cut out a tumor from somebody, do pathology on it, and realize that it has this mutation, well, then you'll know what chemotherapies not to use because they're not going to be effective for these cancer cells.
So you're just... You're basically defining the mechanisms as to how that would work.
Exactly.
And the point is that was what will enable us in the future to perhaps resect a tumor, analyze it sufficiently, and then develop the treatment that will really be most effective.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cutting edge, I'd say.
I was excited when I found it.
I think so. So in a little bit of time, tell me, what do you hope to accomplish then, both in the short term and then maybe as you look ahead?
I think the first thing is to graduate, because this will be my fifth year, so it'd be nice to move on to bigger and better things.
And then you would have your doctorate at that
exactly,
point.
Exactly, I'd have my PhD. Mm-hmm. So then from there, I'd like to go back to the West Coast, where my family is, and hopefully either get into academia, if there are positions, or stick to industry and continue doing cancer research or cancer therapies or anything. And I'm open to anything, but I'd like to stay within the cancer field.
And do you have have you imagined what you hope to kind of have accomplished, let's say, in 5 years from now or 10 years from now?
Well, I think that's hard to imagine, but I would love to have found maybe a better therapy or other ways to treat without so much cytotoxic effects, so the patients aren't suffering as much during treatment, because having gone through it myself, the chemotherapy and radiation isn't the most delightful thing to go through. So if we can find a combination of different therapies that make the side effects less, I think that would be, I'd call that a success.
I would too. How would you counsel other students at this point who might be contemplating a career in research? What would you tell them?
Make sure that you want to do it. I think a lot of people jump into research and think that it's easy and it's just, you kind of do it. It actually takes a lot of, I would say,
discipline.
Discipline, yes, but you also have to, every day sometimes it's redundancy and it can drive you a little wild if you're doing the same thing for 6 months and it's working, and then all of a sudden it doesn't work and you have no idea why and you're beating your head against the wall for months and getting nothing. So
you have to have determination.
Exactly.
And a lot of patience, it sounds like.
Patience, yes. It becomes sometimes a little daunting, and then all of a sudden something works and then you're excited again.
Well, I'm excited very much to have met you and to hear what you're doing, because it sounds like our future and the hope of cancer, finding a cure for cancer, is in the hands of people like you. And it's a real treat and an honor to meet you, and I hope you continue in this path. I can only imagine that you'll be very successful.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to thank you, and sorry to see you leave the East Coast for the West, but fully understand that, you know, you want to go back home.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. My guest has been Chris Lucchese. He's a graduate student in pharmacology at Upstate Medical University, and he's come to tell us a little bit about his research and how a career in cancer research can be incredibly fulfilling. Maybe you'll come back sometime to tell us a little bit about any other breakthrough findings you have.
Of course.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm Upstate psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Well, folks, as some of you know, my 97-year-old mom has Alzheimer's, been sliding downhill for about 10 years. and has been in a nursing home the last two, the most emotionally difficult thing I've ever dealt with. What's made a positive difference for me in dealing with this? A bunch of things. Visiting makes us both feel better, usually. Fact is, it's hard, especially at first. Sometimes there are unpleasant smells and people yelling and looking and acting weird. But if you think about it, not much different than being at work. Sense of humor helps, too. Accepting that I don't have to be a scintillating conversationalist helps. The old standbys like the weather, the sports teams, don't you have a pretty sweater on? Isn't that a cute picture on the wall? The oldest girl is reading to the younger ones. Yeah, pretty, aren't they? They're more than good enough. Being agreeable when mom isn't making sense or understanding my words and my responding in tune with the emotional tone of what she's trying to say. Like if it sounds sort of like she likes her food, oh, I'm glad you're enjoying it, even if her words don't tell me that. Making friends with other residents and their visitors. Like with most things in life, perhaps especially with difficult things, having friends who know what we feel makes it better, much better. Smiling and saying hello to folks who don't show any interest in me or much of anything, that often pays off. They look up, eventually smile, and wave back sometimes, and chatting for a second. For both of us, and for the whole room, actually, it pays off, because everybody sees what everybody else is doing. Remembering people's names, sometimes when the person couldn't even tell you what it is, like my friend Ida, who every time I say, "Hi, Ida," says, "Oh, you remembered my name," and a big smile. Taking in the kindness of strangers, the pastor and his children's choir singing Christmas carols, the woman brings her affectionate doggy, the lady playing piano and singing, the guy who brings a smile and a chat and a pat on the back. Appreciating the staff doing a pretty hard job, especially when mom or dad are uncooperative or downright mean. Real thank yous feel good on all sides. Bottom line, what helps? Bringing my best self, my attentive, friendly, helpful, considerate, grateful, patient self, which isn't always available, but bringing it anyway. What goes around comes around. We can't help getting older, but young or old, being nice makes for happier from 2 to 102. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Up, how a new theory about clubfoot may change the way it's treated. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm Simone Seward, an instructor in public health and preventive medicine at Upstate, with the Healthy Monday Minute for February 17th. Give in to temptation. Forbidding certain foods, like Valentine's chocolate or wine, is a common diet strategy, but studies have shown that this can actually lead to overeating. Food restrictors often satiate their cravings by eating other high-calorie items, which can lead to weight gain. Learning how to effectively cope with trigger foods will leave you feeling in control and improves your chances of maintaining your weight. Instead of fearing your favorite foods, figure out how to budget a small portion into your week. Simply removing the forbidden food label from a food can greatly reduce cravings for it. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Clubfoot. It's a congenital deformity of the foot that occurs in about 200,000 babies each year worldwide, resulting from the abnormal development of the foot while the fetus is forming during pregnancy. And while researchers have been unable to pinpoint the exact cause of clubfoot, there have been some recent compelling hypotheses which can profoundly impact treatment for this deformity. And here with more on this are Dr. David Hutnick. He's a clinical professor of orthopedics, anatomy, and pediatrics, and Dr. Mark Levinson, a clinical professor of radiology, both from Upstate Medical University. Thanks for coming in, gentlemen. Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start with you, Dr. Levinson. I understand that both of you and another colleague are veteran researchers in this, in the causes and best treatments for clubfoot. Tell us about that.
Well, thank you, Linda. About 40 years ago, Dr. Hutnick and I, and also Dr. Packard, who is a member of the Department of Anatomy and Cell Biology, began collaborating on our interest in the abnormal development of the foot, particularly club foot, and some other conditions that are related. And we had the idea that the arterial supply was abnormal and led to both the problem and some of the complications associated with that. So we did quite a bit of laboratory work, primarily using the chicken as our animal, research animal, and we found that there was abnormality in the arterial supply to the foot that we felt led to the development of clubfoot.
So basically, that's your hypothesis. I want to get more on that in just a minute, but Dr. Hutnick, help us understand when we say clubfoot, what do we mean?
Well, it's a descriptive term, and it just means any foot that is positioned, turned in, and in a downward position. It's really not very enlightened, and it's a term that doesn't really have any specific meaning because we can't describe all the different deformities in it. And the big news in all of this is that nobody ever knew that the blood vessels were missing. We're talking about all through history. The dissections that had been done of limbs that were amputated therapeutically had never been looked at. And moreover, it's not just clubfoot. The clubfoot is just part of a greater spectrum of birth deformities, congenital short limb, missing bones, something called congenital vertical talus, which is sort of the mirror image of clubfoot. But clubfoot is attractive to talk about because it's something that everybody can envision.
So
that's why
apparent.
We've used that.
It's the most apparent kind of symptom, so to speak.
It's something that we can all talk about because everybody thinks they know what it means. But no layperson has any greater understanding of clubfoot than the most sophisticated researcher because they're still looking at trees. In other words, what we've been able to do because of our research is instead of looking at trees, see the forest. And the forest involves looking at the blood vessels first. And that came to us because of some original research that we started in London many years ago.
So basically, you have come up with this hypothesis that the reason why a child is born, and they're born with this deformity, is because there's some malformation embryonically in the arteria, basically their arteries, to their limbs. Is that correct?
Well, let's just say there's an association because you don't want Dr. Levinson to get angry with me while we're on the air. So we'll say there's an association between the missing blood vessels and the deformities. But there are many different deformities that have the same missing blood vessels. And this is not known popularly in scientific circles. Among PhDs particularly, is research emphasis at NIH over the past decade or two has been towards looking at genes and trying to investigate the genome. But the kinds of things that we're looking at occur after the limb model is formed, and that's why Dr. Packard was so important in working on this research.
So when does it take place in the development of the fetus, typically?
Well, at about 5 to 6 weeks of development, of the fetus, five or 6 weeks after fertilization, the limb is already sufficiently developed so that either clubfoot is there or not, and the arterial pattern is also developed such that it, at that point, approaches an adult pattern. Prior to that, the arterial pattern is quite different, and it really has an embryonic pattern that goes through multiple transitions to form the adult pattern. But about 5 or 6 weeks of age, the adult pattern is there, both in the limb appearance and in the arterial appearance.
So how did you know in this research that you did that the embryonic pattern that you were looking at was not normal? I mean, what research predated that, or was this based on?
Well, in some of the babies who were scheduled to have surgery, they underwent what's called an arteriogram, an X-ray examination looking at the arteries. And we noticed that the arteriogram was abnormal in almost all of the babies who had clubfoot and other associated diseases. And when we looked at what that abnormality was, we recognized that it was the same pattern that babies went through at about 5 weeks of development, but it was the pattern stopped developing and didn't proceed on to the normal mature adult.
So it's
pattern.
Kind of a stunted development.
It's a stunted development of the arteries at that time, and we believe that that's the same time that the bony abnormality occurs.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. I'm here with Drs. David Hutnick and Mark Levinson, and we're talking about the causes of clubfoot, which is a birth defect, and we're going to get on to talking about what can be done about it. Let's start, Dr. Hutnick, currently, how is clubfoot treated these days?
We recognize clubfoot as a mechanical deformity, and so it's primarily treated mechanically with casting. The latest theory holds that it's better to treat with something called the Ponseti technique, which involves casting starting as early as possible after birth when the deformity is noted. And the majority of feet will correct, but some won't.
Yeah, when you say correct, so what you're saying is through proper casting, you can really attain a normal foot at that point? Or a normal functioning foot?
Precisely. Normal functioning foot is what you're looking for, because invariably the limbs in the children with club feet are shorter, even though it may be a small amount. The feet are smaller. Sometimes they have to wear different size shoes. But most interestingly, even after the deformity is corrected with casting, the children have to be followed till the foot has reached at least half of adult normal size, which is about age 7 or 8, because there's a tendency for the deformity to recur. And that's where our research is very important.
Yes, tell us why.
Well, it turns out that the missing blood vessels are missing mostly on the inside of the foot where there's less growth. So there's more growth on the outer side of the foot. So it's not exactly that the deformity is reoccurring. It's that normal growth on the outside of the foot goes on, and the inside of the foot or the inner side doesn't grow, and that causes the club foot to reoccur.
So what are the implications then? I clearly understand that at this point, to date or before this, there wasn't a real understanding of the etiology or the cause of club foot. You know, people were just dealing with it symptomatically, so to speak. What are the implications of what your findings suggest or what your hypothesis suggests?
Well, it helps provide some understanding of why researchers have had problems with this. And Drs. Levinson and Packard and I have actually published the world's collection or review paper on cases where there were are complications related to the missing arteries in club feet. We went all over the country, and in fact, the only other case that's ever been published where a child had a complication after club foot surgery was in the Shrine Hospital in Mexico City, published in 1968. Other than that, we've got all of the cases that have ever been published, and they're from all over the United States.
But just getting back to my initial point, will treatment change, and if so, how? With this understanding?
Of course, the first question that everybody would ask in a situation like this is, how do you prevent the deformity from occurring in the first place?
Yes, that was my next question.
There's some research that's been done down at the University of Texas that shows that maternal smoking affects the blood vessels in children. So the first step would be to get mothers who are pregnant to stop smoking, which would affect the development of the arteries. Then anything that would cause the blood vessels to be abnormal would potentially affect the growth of the limbs. And clubfoot's about equal in incidence to the congenital short limb, which was originally what we looked at. But all of those conditions are affected by blood flow in the fetus in the embryonic time that Dr. Levinson referred to, which is 5 to 6 weeks. And I would beg any mother who's pregnant, and you know you're pregnant, but of course this happens oftentimes before pregnancy is known, please stop smoking. That's the one thing we know.
So smoking really is a very strong contributor to a problem with the arterial development. Are there other known dangers that we could prevent, if we could intervene, we could prevent this?
Anything connected with blood vessels. So you'd have to talk to the pediatricians and the obstetricians and the teratologists. And that's where we are right now. Those are the people we're talking to.
Well, that's very exciting.
I could add also that we do have some research that shows that sometimes in early development at that time, if the baby develops momentary hypertension, that can sometimes be related to bleeds that may cause this problem to develop also.
And why would that happen?
I don't know.
Utero?
There has to be more research done on that area.
Very interesting. I understand that you both held a colloquium in the recent past here at Upstate Medical University, and you had some people coming from all over the country to discuss these findings?
It was an excellent adventure.
Yeah, so it was successful, I understand.
Yeah, it was very good. We had really top researchers in many different fields who came here, and we're going to be publishing a report on that colloquium soon.
Well, we look forward to seeing it. And I understand also you've had some trouble finding funding, and in this very dysfunctional Congress that we have with the sequester, a lot of people are in that same boat. Are you going to be able to continue your research despite that?
Of course.
Good answer.
Most of our research has been done with private funding ourselves and not through government funding.
Well, I applaud your work so far, and I look forward to hearing more wonderful stories. My guests have been Dr. David Hutnick. He's a clinical professor of orthopedics, anatomy, and pediatrics, and Dr. Mark Levinson, clinical professor of radiology at Upstate Medical University. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Very interesting information. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse. Sometimes a poem uses allusions to open us to further interpretations. These references can take us back into the past and deepen our sense of what is happening to us in the present. I often enjoy taking that journey with our writers. Poet Lisa Baker from San Francisco sent us a poem whose speaker is trying to reassure her beloved companion that they will survive the devastating diagnosis they have been given. Her reassurance takes the form of artistic allusions, especially a favorite artist, Eva Hess. The poem can stand on its own, but it becomes much richer when we know that Eva Hess, sculptor and artist, was only 34 when she succumbed to her brain tumor. Here is Lisa Baker's Connections, inspired by Connections, Eva Hess, 1969. I was searching for a photograph of Eva's pendulous wires because they help me understand something I cannot name. I was searching for her resin-coated thin wires with needle-eye hooks on the top end, dangling from long filaments open to draft. Covered wires, utterly raw in their vulnerability, in their exposed, fixed, and unfixed states, in their awkward randomness and union of still, somber isolation, like you and I are here today. I suppose Eva must have dipped the wires in some small tin of warmed resins, naturally colored and translucent embers, and gently lowered them the way candle wicks are into melted beeswax, then left to dry, one layer at a time. Resins, with tiny air bubbles trapped inside and in irregular and beautiful shapes like vanilla beans or ballerina arms, slightly twisting, longing in their lengths, or withering boiled cartilages with no blood remains. Perhaps instead she dabbed those wires in resins with a single hairbrush, exactingly, like the old Taoist painters did, or point by point like Seurat. Inspired by Calder, form's continuous play to motion and to light, testing the Murano rod to the furnace flame, pulling to find just how long molten glass can be pulled before it breaks and curls back into itself. Affirming Giacometti, who came to understand the soundness of the thinnest line like a single strand of spider silk can be enough. And now, my love, what are we to do as the neurotransmitters in your brain are askew, damaged by some invader whose violence continues day by day in quiet, stealing, insidious ways? I'll stay near, and if I could, I'd gently model each tender cell and fragile line in sweet golden wax to somehow hold them in time. I'd barter with the spider for her new spun silks to sew your membranes back together in microscopic stitch, transcribing your wishes upon them as you dream of what might have been. I'll wrap your precious thoughts in butterfly cocoons, my dear, and we'll paint them with single hairbrushes in any colors you choose.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn how improving colorectal cancer screening can save lives and how medical students are becoming bilingual to better serve their patients. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.